Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to stream our television show, get our recipes, or take our free online cooking classes. Enjoy the show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Massimo Bottura is an Italian restaurateur. He's also chef patron of Osteria Francescana. This is a 3-Michelin-star restaurant based in Modena. His latest cookbook is called Bread is Gold, and it documents the recipes created at Refettorio Ambrosiano. This is his soup kitchen he founded in Milan in 2015. Along with many of the top chefs in the world, they came together to transform food waste into a 3-star dining experience.
The Pope said we go and we give light to the periphery. And periphery is very important for me, as the food waste is periphery of food, as the people we are feeding are the periphery of humanity.
Before we chat with Massimo, I have reporter Rebecca Lee Douglas here, who recently investigated a very strange food disorder. It's called ARFID, A-R-F-I-D. People with this condition find most foods so frightening and repulsive that they live on a very highly restrictive diet. Rebecca originally reported on this phenomenon on her podcast called Group, distributed by Acast. Rebecca, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Chris?
So you did a story on ARFID.
Yes.
Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. Can you tell me what that is?
Sure. Yeah. It's a disorder which was actually just added to the most recent DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And it's a eating disorder, but it has nothing to do with body image, which is different than, you know, some of the other eating disorders that we usually think about, like anorexia or bulimia. And a lot of people who have ARFID will only eat like a handful of different types of very specific food. And some people will only eat like one or two types of food.
And of course, you interviewed folks who do have this condition. Who did you interview and what did they have to say?
I spoke with Morgan Ashley Gale, who is a 20-year-old art student. So Morgan mainly ate bread and cheese products. For a while, she only ate bread products. So she would eat like bread and butter sandwiches. Peanut butter was her only source of protein. But yeah, she ended up adding cheese to her diet, which added a little bit more protein. But now it's mainly like waffles, grilled cheese, macaroni and cheese. Adding pizza to her diet was like a huge thing for her. Here's Morgan.
So it feels, if someone is encouraging me to eat something that I feel like I can't eat, it feels like I am standing in front of a brick wall and someone is telling me to walk through the brick wall and they're not understanding that I can't walk through the brick wall like it's a wall. My chest feels really tight from my anxiety. It's not pleasant.
A lot of people who have ARFID, I've heard them describe types of food that are not their safe food or, you know, one of those limited foods that they feel comfortable eating as like when they look at it, it doesn't look edible to them. So what Morgan was referring to there is like if you were asked to eat like a stick or a rock or something that you just know is not food and you wouldn't eat. So for her, there's that element there, and then there's also this element of extreme fear.
So you mentioned fear, you know, safe foods, which implies some deep anxiety. Do you know if it's color, texture, smell, or is it the actual idea of the food that creates that fear?
I think it's different for each individual who has ARFID. For some people, it is more like an anxiety disorder or a phobia, where it is like just an extreme fear of these new foods that aren't on their safe list. And then for other folks, it might have something more to do with texture of the food, with the smell of the food. Unlike people who are picky eaters, though, it doesn't have to do with the way the food tastes.
How do they know it's a disorder? What is the definition of a disorder? Let's start with that.
What would make it a disorder is if it affects your life to a degree where it becomes sort of like your world. So whereas somebody who might have a picky eating habit or might not like certain types of foods, but they're still able to get most of their nourishment and, you know, the vitamins and minerals that they need in order to function in a healthy way, then that's not a disorder. A lot of individuals who have ARFID, yeah, it affects them medically also. One of the folks that I spoke with just recently had to have his entire colon removed.
This is because of the restrictive diet?
Yeah, his doctors think it's connected. For a while, his only two safe foods were hamburger patties and French fries.
Well, there may be a connection
Yeah. So that was all he ate for 14 years was just hamburger patties and French fries. So yeah, so it's quite different than picky eating. If it affects your health and your social life to a degree where it can be crippling, that's a disorder.
Is there some other condition similar to ARFID that gives you any clues as to what's happening and why?
I think that probably the most similar condition would be either a phobia. So the way that I was able to relate to it is I have pretty bad arachnophobia. I'm terrified of spiders. And one of the mental health professionals that I spoke with, Dr. Kim DeRay, was saying that, you know, it would be like a spider on a plate. So, you know, if quite often when she's trying to get people to understand what ARFID is like, she will literally put a snake on a plate and then she'll be like, here, eat this. So for me, you know, I was picturing a restaurant filled with spiders on plates. You know, folks with ARFID, quite often it's very hard for them to go to restaurants because they have this phobia that kicks in.
Do they find people with ARFID also have compensating abilities of perception in other areas?
Oh, absolutely. One of the women who I spoke with, Erin Kreck, blogs as ARFID Mom. She has a 10-year-old son, and she says that he has superhero senses, is how she describes it. So he will smell things that she can't smell. He has a very sensitive sense of touch. It took a very long time for him to be able to take a shower and put water on his head because he was hyper aware of all of the little feelings of the water droplets. So here's Erin.
It really started to present in the second half of his first year when other kids were beginning to progress from the pureed baby foods or the pureed cereals and from the bottled milk to foods that had more texture to them. My son never really took that step. There was a big struggle in presenting those foods to him. He was turning those foods away. And so really by 1 year of age, this seemed so different from other kids. He didn't even eat his birthday cake at his first birthday party. And that was pretty sad to me.
So what do you think is the future for treatment for this disorder?
So it seems like there is some really interesting research going on. I spoke with Dr. Evelyn Atiyya. She's the director of eating disorder research at Columbia University Medical Center. And she was actually one of the individuals who wrote the entry for ARFID in the new DSM. Here's Dr. Atiyya.
The National Institutes for Health, I know, have become very interested in helping the field and the American public learn more about this relatively newly described condition. And there are some trials trying to identify some treatment strategies. And needless to say, that's going to be extremely important because when people now are aware that they are running into a problem that clinicians can better recognize, well, they're very eager for us to be able to do something about this.
Rebecca, thank you very much. That was really fascinating.
Thank you.
That was Rebecca Lee Douglas. She produces a podcast called Group about mental health that's distributed through Acast. Mill Street Radio is also available as a podcast. You can subscribe, download our shows on your phone, and listen anytime. New shows are available every Friday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, and Spotify. Right now, my co-host, Sarah Moulton, and I will take some of your calls. Sarah, of course, is the star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on Public Television, also author of the book Home Cooking 101. Sarah, are you ready?
You bet.
Welcome to Mill Street Radio. Who's calling?
This is Candace. I'm calling from Brainerd, Minnesota.
How can we help you?
I have a dilemma. I have one of those lovely old recipes from a grandmother that's very sketchy.
Okay.
And I have a significant other who would really, really, really like for me to make a rhubarb cream pie with a caramelized crust. Mm. It's my understanding that instead of your basic flaky pie crust, which is what I'm accustomed to making, it's got a thicker, chewy texture.
Why is it called caramelized? Because it has a lot of sugar in the crust, you think?
Yeah, that's what I would guess. The closest I can figure is take a pre-made pie crust and poke holes in it and allow the sugar and, you know, to my understanding, a caramelized crust, it happens accidentally.
Sounds yummy. Love the idea.
Well, I do have a suggestion.
Okay.
You can. Now, is this a two-crust pie or a one-crust pie or a lattice pie?
One crust pie.
There goes that suggestion.
I wonder if it's something like a graham cracker crust with a whole lot of sugar in it
or something.
Yeah, that's
what I think.
The recipe itself is very sketchy.
Well, does it say anything about the crust at all? Is it flour? Is it nuts? Is it graham crackers? Is it cookies?
The recipe says, cut your rhubarb into small cubes and place in pie crust.
That's pretty sketchy.
That's real sketchy.
And bake until done. Add sugar.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
It gives a little bit more instruction for the cream portion of it that you pour over the rhubarb.
And I assume it has a substantial amount of sugar in this, otherwise it would be inedible.
Right.
Well, things I know are this. This is all I know. Some recipes, let's say, like sweet potato pie, you can put a layer of brown sugar on a crust. And you get a layer of sugar at the very bottom, which is nice. You can brush the exposed crust with water. You don't need milk or cream. And then liberally sprinkle sugar on it. And you get a really nice sugary, either on a top crust or on the crust around the edge of a one crust pie. So that would give you a nice crackly, really nice sugary crust. Or I guess you could up the amount of sugar in your crust. I would use graham crackers or vanilla wafers or something with melted butter and sugar.
Brown sugar.
And then pat in the pan crust and pre-bake it for 20 minutes until it sets and then
brown
cool
sugar.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The crust you get with a pecan pie, the bottom crust, is, in my mind, the closest to a caramelized crust that I can conceive of.
I think this is something that Sarah Moulton's kitchen ought to
test. I think Milk Street.
Not Milk Street.
My kitchen is me, myself, and myself.
I know she used a glass Pyrex plate.
Yes, of course.
Yes, I know, because I actually have the pie plate that she used.
Is there anybody else you could interview besides your friend?
I asked for a little more detail on the crust. I said, was it crispy at all? Was it thick and chewy? And the answer I got was it was chewy.
Chewy.
Not a flaky crust at all.
I'm stumped. Here's what I would do. I would cross out the word caramelized on the recipe and make a rhubarb cream pie with your crust. Just don't worry about it.
I think I'll just tweak it as I go along.
Don't let the weight of history
drag
cloud
you down.
The future.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. That's the best we can do. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Candace.
Thanks, Candace.
I do appreciate your
yeah.
help. Thank
Pleasure.
You so much.
Yes. Take care. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Tim from Kansas City.
Is this a barbecue question or something else?
Well, I've got a question about horseradish, actually.
Okay.
I like to put horseradish on broth and other grilled items. I like the flavor of horseradish. The problem is it usually dominates whatever I put it on, and I don't get a lot of other flavors. And I was questioning, how can I make horseradish a little tamer?
Well, for starters, if you grate fresh horseradish and let it sit, it loses flavor pretty quickly.
It loses. As a matter of fact, it becomes downright boring.
Yeah, after a couple hours, an hour. Matter of fact, I did that. I made some boiled beef, which is an Austrian dish a month or two ago. And you finish it with grated horseradish. And I grated it that afternoon.
And let it sit.
And at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, I couldn't taste the horseradish.
No, it just gets so... I mean, right away, you're absolutely right. If you grate it fresh, say, onto oysters or something, you could barely taste the oyster for the horseradish.
Well, you can make a horseradish cream, essentially, with some vinegar, et cetera.
The best thing to do is to arrest that flavor and tame it at the same time by adding salt and vinegar.
Right.
So you grate it first and then add salt and vinegar, and it should be of the heat that you want, or, you know, at least not overwhelming and also not dead as doornails, which it is straight up a couple hours later.
Also, I find if you add horseradish to, like, mashed potatoes, which have fat in it, I find fat tends to ameliorate the bite of horseradish.
But would this be horseradish that you already put vinegar and salt on?
No, no. If you grate horseradish and put it and mix it into mashed potatoes
at the last
minute, cream and butter, I find that the fat also
cuts down that heat.
Cuts that really bright, tangy heat. Yeah.
Yeah, I do want to say, because I think fresh horseradish is wonderful, but you have to be careful because it's so intense when you grate it, right, Tim?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it makes you really cry. You know, I wanted to do a big batch, and I thought, oh, well, I'll just chop it up in the food processor. You know, if you put it in the food processor and lift off that lid, it's like napalm in your eyes. It's terrible. My suggestion would be to add vinegar and salt.
My suggestion is leave it sit around for 2 or 3 hours, and then,
okay.
It'll be very, very mild. So there you go. Thanks for calling.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
bye.
Take care. This is Mostly Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you want to know why your cheesecake cracks or why your cream sauce separates, give us a call anytime. 855-426-9843. That's 855-426-9843. Or please send us an email. We'd love to hear from you at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Hi, this is Dori Berkowitz.
Hi, Dori. How can we help you?
Well, I am the world's worst housekeeper, but my kitchen is very clean.
Good for you.
My problem is my glass lids for the cookware. And, you know, on TV, they're always crystal clear and sparkling, and I can't imagine they use new lids every time.
Yes, we do. No, that's what happens. Yeah, every season of every cooking show, they buy new lids, yeah. Let's be honest.
I'm so defeated.
I know. The truth always hurts, yeah.
So all the different methods that I've tried to no avail are really to no avail.
Well, I did ask our food editor, Matt Card. He and I were on the road recently doing some things, some events, and he told me that vodka is very good at cleaning off residue from glass and things. And actually, he's worked in a restaurant for many years. He says they use it a lot. Of course, I guess there's a lot of vodka around. But use it as a cleaner. So I don't know.
I've never heard that.
I never heard that either.
You know what? Sometimes I do if it's baked on in an area that you can get to, you know, not in a crevice on the glass lid.
Right.
I'll use a razor blade.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I use a
kind
razor.
Kind of like what I use for my, I have the smooth cooktop.
Me
and
too.
I use the razor blade to get gunk
Me too.
Off of there.
Yeah. It's not going to hurt the glass at all. Just make sure you don't hurt you.
Yeah, well.
So do you walk around town with a box cutter or what? I mean,
I have one in my drawer.
You do?
Yeah.
Really? Wow.
Well,
I guess
don't mess
no
with Sarah.
Vodka. I get no vodka if you're going to use the razor blade.
Well, I think vodka is just for grease. It's not going to be for baked on stuff.
Okay.
If you have a greasy top, that we get rid of the grease, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're clean because they're squeaky when I finish washing them, but they never get clear again.
Well, there's two ways of dealing with things like this. One is not to notice.
Yeah. Well,
and I don't really care as long as it's clean. It's not horrific.
Right.
I mean, you were talking about little bits and pieces of baked on food.
No, not pieces of schmutz. Just they never get clear. They always have some sort of, if you hold it up to the light, and I'm not that obsessive, really, I'm the world's worst housekeeper, but if you hold it up to the light, you can see it's just, you know, it's just not clear
glass. Well,
is
this because it has, well, it could be there are tiny little scratches all over the glass. You think that's what it is from cleaning? You use something a little abrasive on it, and maybe you scratch the glass. That's what I think. Maybe.
Oh, terrific. Okay.
I'm supposed to make you feel better when you call. I'm not supposed to depress you. But if it's clean, you say it's clean, there's nothing baked on, but it's just translucent, not transparent, I would say you've got scratches.
There are, you know, areas on it that just always look iffy.
I think may have used something a little too strong on it, probably.
I say try vodka.
Okay.
Drink vodka, and then you won't worry about your glass lids on your cookware. Right.
That's right. One for me, one for the lid.
Right.
There you go. There you go. I think I just wouldn't worry about it.
That's
and TV shows get new lids every year.
Yeah.
So that's how
it works. You don't need to feel bad about
that.
Okay. Dori.
Thank you so much, and I'm so happy about Milk Street.
Thank you.
I'm enjoying every part of it.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Dori.
Okay.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Coming up next, my conversation with Massimo Bottura, an Italian restaurateur and the chef patron of Osteria Francescana, a 3-star Michelin restaurant based in Modena. His latest book is called Bread is Gold. Coming up after the break. Massimo Bottura is an Italian restaurateur, also chef patron of Osteria Francescana, a 3-star Michelin restaurant based in Modena. His latest book is Bread is Gold, and it documents the recipes created at Refettorio Ambrosiano. This was an impromptu soup kitchen created in Milan by some of the top chefs in the world. So your new book is Bread is Gold. It's based on a recipe, a bread and milk recipe from your childhood. Just tell us very quickly how your mother made that.
It's a recipe that my mom was cooking for me when before going to bed. A warm cup of milk, some breadcrumbs, a little bit of sugar, chocolate or coffee, depends what we add. And it was my favorite meal. And if I'm thinking about my daughter's favorite recipe, that is breadcrumbs, some parmigiano, some eggs, and a touch of nutmeg, make very quick a little dough, squeeze into the squeezer for mashed potato, and cook this breadcrumbs noodle into a chicken broth, is my daughter's favorite. And that was a recipe that inspires me when 2 years ago I decided to interpret the Universal Exposition by myself, involving the 65 most influential chefs in the world. So bread is gold if you look at the bread with the right eyes, if you ask bread the right question, you know.
So let's just set the stage here, literally. So there's an exposition in Milan, I believe, in 2015.
Yeah, and it's a universal exposition. It's one of every 4 years. That was before it was in Beijing, and then after it was in Milan.
And you got the idea of taking all the wasted food at that time and then having these chefs cook these meals. Now, could you describe, there was an old theater there from the 1930s, and you went in and redid it. So what was the name of the theater, and how did you refurbish it for the Refettorio, which I in English I assume means refectory, which is a place monks and nuns would eat their meals. Right.
Exactly, exactly. You know, the numbers of the needy, you know, the people, they don't have anything to eat, are 860 million. And we have 1.5 billion overweight and 1.3 billion tons of food that are wasted every year. So the answer is very easy. First of all, if you want to feed the planet, you have to fight waste. And so I knock at the door of the church, and 1 week later, they call me and they said, come to Milan, please. But the Pope said, we go and we give light to the periphery. And periphery is very important for me, as the food waste is periphery of food, as the people we are feeding are the periphery of humanity. So we went there. We went to this neglected neighborhood in Milan called Quartiere Greco, and we took over the movie theater from 1930. And with the help of the architects, designers, and artists, we create an amazing place, first of all, to rebuild the dignity of the people, to create hospitality, to create a place who rediscover the old pleasure of what it is to cook for people. And all the best chefs in the world, they said, yes, of course, we're going to be with you. Canada sponsored a documentary that is now on Netflix called Theater of Life. And but to spread the word, I think we need a book.
You say beauty without good isn't beautiful. Good needs beauty to convey its message. So when you say you need beauty, how does beauty and good go together?
You know, the moment you involve the best chef in the world, they're going to give you time, creativity, and vision. So, you know, we have to imagine what is going to be. And this is the beauty of creativity. Man is not living by bread alone. These are very important words that I think that make the difference. An example. We open, after Milan, we open Rio de Janeiro, in the most dangerous place in Rio, in Lapa. We open Modena, Bologna, and London. The day first, London. Day one, we open, and after the service, an old lady asked for a microphone. she said to me, can I have a microphone? Because I want to, you know, share my idea with everyone. So I said, of course. And she started like this. This is one of the most beautiful places I ever seen in my life. This is going to create community for us. It's going to be the very, very, very important for everybody. And now I can die very happy. I'm 92. Everyone start crying, you know. She got immediately the feeling and the message that we try to transfer with this project, you know.
Let's talk about you for a second. So you opened a trattoria back in the 1980s, but you didn't have a lot of experience cooking professionally, but you opened it pretty quickly. So what was that like in the first the first couple nights when you were a chef and a restaurateur?
Actually, I was very, very, very lucky. My mom was a great gourmet, very good cook, but she was cooking for 10, 20 people every day, you know, the family, very large family. And so together, we became very successful immediately from day one. And after a couple of years, the traditional cuisine was enough for me because I was exposed since I was a kid to many different cuisine and great food. So I met this French chef, two-star Michelin, who was working in Piacenza. And he really went deep into classic cuisine. So what came out was like French classic technique mixed with traditional Emilia food. Like Emilia Romagna is called the food valley because it's like a mythic place. And, you know, at that point, Alain Ducasse came and ate at the Osteria Francescana. That was 92. And he was really impressed by the food I was serving him and invite me in to cook with him at Monte Carlo at the Hotel de Paris, Louis XV. It was a three-star Michelin, very innovative at that time because it was the first French chef who was switching butter and cream with olive oil. And he was the first one who brought vegetables into the pan and the plate.
So what was it like working with Ducasse at Louis XV? Just give us a couple examples of something he was doing that you just said, well, you know, I've never seen that before.
Yeah, it was like, it was a dream, you know. At that time, there was another place like that in the world. Ducasse was able to do whatever he wants in just that hotel. You know, he had the top floor, with a very traditional restaurant. He had the main floor, very casual, and the garden on the piazza that was Louis XV. And then you had a room called the Salampier for the kings. They were the guests of Ranieri, you know, the prince of Monaco. And so Ducasse, what he did with me, he said, you can do whatever you want. You choose. And I remember one of the key points of my career was when I left the hotel. And I met him in the lobby. He looked at me and he said, so how you feel? I said, I feel great. You know, it's an incredible experience, but I have to go back now. And he said to me, so did you take notes? Do you have something? I said, yeah, I have a book full of notes. And it's incredible. It's beautiful. And he said, show me, show me. You know what he did? He crashed the book. Just like that. He threw it in the garbage saying, you can't stand up on your feet. Go. You know, it was shocking for me. Shocking. I was mad for 2 years, but I understood. I understood what he was talking about. He said, don't recreate those recipes. Don't do that because it would be just a copy. Just trust yourself and trust your palate and go and cook whatever you want.
Yeah, let me ask another question. Do you think, let's take Italy. Is there a moment in the development of a culture where you think the food and the culture are perfectly suited for each other, and it's the best. For example, there's, what, 30, 40% food waste in the world today with modern culture. But in Italy in the 1930s, my guess is there was almost no food waste, right? So no. was there a moment in Italy, for example, when you think the culture was at its highest and so was the food, or we just continue evolving?
I remember my grandmother about developing this idea that you were talking about. Starting from that reason, I'm thinking about my grandmother when she was saying to me, our country guys, they are killing the pig next week. So we have to go. And we were going there and said, you know, this is a spiritual act because this pig is part of the family. And so he's giving his life for, you know, to feed the whole family for the whole year. You know, so we have to use every single bones, every single thing. And most of the plates, the recipes from the basis Italian cuisine comes from this reason. You know, you don't throw away anything because with the knowledge that we have, we can create amazing food with nothing. And the book is about that, you know, ordinary ingredients, extraordinary meals.
Yeah, that seems like you said it perfectly in just a few words. Massimo, thank you. I love the book.
Thank you.
And it's one of those rare books where you have top chefs doing something that actually makes sense for the home kitchen as well. So
it's very important to me. And, you know, we ask that. And before publish it, we try every single recipe home with all my guys from Osteria Francescana in their day off. They were trying all these different recipes, and we were correcting them with the right proportion. So you're going to make home every single recipe, I bet.
Well, when I get through the whole book, I'll call you. And I'll
good.
Have,
good.
And I'll have
you're
going to
win a prize. You're going to win a prize, a dinner at Osteria.
Okay. Massimo, thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me, too.
That was Massimo Bottura, an Italian restaurateur, also chef at Osteria Francescana, a 3-star Michelin restaurant based in Modena. His newest cookbook is called Bread is Gold, which documents the recipes created at Refettorio Ambrosiano, his soup kitchen combating food waste. Orson Welles once said, "The enemy of art is the absence of limitations." Or translated to the kitchen, you might say, "Too many choices spoils the broth." Massimo Bottura's most memorable recipe is his mother's, warm milk, bread, sugar, and chocolate. That's not comfort food. That's just good food. Right now, I'm heading over to the kitchen in Milk Street to chat with Catherine Smart about this week's recipe. Catherine, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Okay, I'm going to rant about cheesecakes. I don't like wet cheesecakes, and I don't like heavy cheesecakes. And about 20 years ago, I was in New York, below house and near the Bowery somewhere, and there was a great Italian restaurant, and they had a ricotta cheesecake, which is nothing new, but it had almost a black top to it. It was cracked. It was nice and dry. It was kind of light and had a lot of flavor. And so instead of just cream cheese, obviously ricotta is the base. So I thought we should take a shot at that because I like it. That's an excellent reason to do a recipe. So how do we get started?
So just to start, Chris, you just said that you liked a dry, black, cracked cheesecake. So I just sort of want to break it down for anyone listening that it is delicious, and it really is a cheesecake. I mean, we use ricotta, like you said. We also use mascarpone, which is basically an Italian cream cheese, but it's a little bit lighter. It's a little bit creamier. This cheesecake has some structure to it because we add a little bit of semolina flour, which, you know, we think of pasta in the U.S., but just a little bit gives it that beautiful crust and also gives it some structure. And in the end, you end up with a much lighter, not soggy, leaden cheesecake.
So is this the same gig? Whole eggs, cream cheese or cheese, standing mixer, beat them, put them in a springform pan, and then, of course, into the water bath.
No, Chris. Two things. First of all, it's basically the same technique, but you do need to whip the egg whites. That's going to give you that light, fluffy structure we're looking for. But happy news for you, no water bath is necessary. You're simply going to throw it in the oven and bake it for 40 to 45 minutes. You do want to tap it on the counter before you throw it in the oven to get rid of any air bubbles. And then when it just is set but has a little bit of jiggle, you take it out. And then, of course, you have to be patient. It needs to cool for 2 hours and then needs to go into the fridge to cool a bit longer, but no water bath.
So no water bath. But now let's get to the most often asked culinary question in the world, at least America, is why does my cheesecake crack on the top? So does this crack?
Chris, it does, but you don't have to worry about it. So with a traditional cheesecake where you have your water bath, you have your dense piece of cheesecake, if it cracks on top, that probably means you overcooked your cheesecake. Here, you don't have to worry about it. With the light ricotta texture, the egg whites, the semolina, it will crack, but it's not overcooked. So just don't worry about it.
So no water bath, don't have to worry about the cracking, delicious ricotta flavor. What could be better?
Nothing, so it's perfect cheesecake.
Thank you, Catherine.
You're welcome, Chris. You can find our recipe for ricotta semolina cheesecake at 177milkstreet.com.
I'm Christopher Kimball, and you're listening to Milk Street Radio. Coming up, more of your culinary questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton, right after the break. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Now it's time to take some calls with my co-host, Sarah Moulton. Sarah, you ready for a new batch of phone calls?
Yeah, let's take some calls. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's on the line?
This is Pat Henderson from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hi, Pat. How can we help you today?
Well, I have probably would seem an insignificant question to most people, but I see in recipes hot paprika and sweet paprika and smoked. And I'm wondering, does it really make a difference if I just use plain paprika instead of the other?
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you like the flavor of, you know, say, bacon in a recipe? I mean, do you like that smoked aroma?
Some things, like pita bread, I like the smoked paprika in sour cream and some beans mashed up on pita bread. So it's good that way.
Are you a spicy person or not so much?
Not so much.
Was that a philosophical question or was that a culinary question?
That was a culinary question.
No. The short answer is it makes a huge difference because a hot versus mild versus smoky are totally different. And a smoked paprika, which they use, of course, in Spain.
You can also get hot smoked and cold smoked, yeah.
Of course.
It can both be spicy and smoky.
Well, okay, but here's an example. My sister-in-law, about 6 months ago, made a recipe from Milk Street, and it called for a tablespoon of paprika. She mistakenly used a tablespoon of chili powder. And needless to say, it was almost inedible. So hot versus sweet versus smoky would be very different.
Yeah. But because you're not such a spicy person, maybe it'd be nice, if you like that smoky taste, to have one smoked, you know, smoked sweet and one plain sweet. Paprika is really a wonderful ingredient. My mother used to use it. And she was a great cook, but she did what everybody else did. You know, she'd put it on hard-boiled eggs,
stuffed eggs,
or she'd put it on top of chicken, which is sort of weird because it burns, and use it, you know, as decoration. But now, you know, because of the Spanish chefs and Hungarian chefs, we know that paprika brings so much more to the mix. You know, I was going to mention one of my favorite sources for things Spanish is La Tienda, and they have, I think, all the different kinds of paprika. So,
well, there's Jose Andres, the famous Spanish chef out of Washington, makes a garlic soup.
Yeah.
It's garlic, stale bread, some water, and smoked paprika, like 3 tablespoons of smoked paprika.
Wow.
And he throws in some olive oil, and he throws in some egg at the end, and it's just fabulous. Smoked.
That sounds so good.
And the smoked paprika just drives the whole thing.
You know, one last thing about smoked paprika is that if you have vegetarians in your family and you want to add some smoke to a recipe, you know, the way people usually do it is through bacon or Canadian bacon or ham. And one way to accommodate vegetarians is to add smoked paprika.
Okay, I'll have bacon and eggs for breakfast and you can have pimenton, smoked paprika with your eggs in the morning.
Well, that would be good, actually.
So the answer is get sweet and get smoked. You can leave aside the...
Okay, thanks, Pat.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, pleasure. Bye-bye. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
This is Chris, too. Good. We're even.
Chris, meet Chris.
Yeah. How can we help you?
There's a lot of recipes that call for feta cheese, and I really can't stand the taste of feta cheese or blue cheese. So is there a good substitute to use?
Cotija, that Mexican fresh cheese, I think is much milder, but it has a similar texture to it. That
ricotta
would be my
salata
choice.
Is ricotta top salata. Of my list, yeah. Which is a salted, drained ricotta cheese. So it's firm. So it's got the same tanginess. My guess is you don't like feta because you think it's sort of barnyardy.
I haven't had it in years because I know I can't stand the taste of it. I love ricotta, though.
Well, ricotta salata is very different than the ricotta you know, but it's nothing like feta. And I agree with Chris about the cotija also.
Yeah, cotija is great if you can find it. It's a drier texture, obviously, than regular cheese.
Okay,
like
great.
Ricotta.
I'd give them a try.
Yeah, cotija or ricotta salata, and that should solve your problem.
I will let you know.
All right.
Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. This week's Milk Street Basic is about a new way to use dried mushrooms. Of course, they add a lot of savor, a lot of umami to any soup, stew, or even a pasta sauce. But the problem is that they require a fair amount of time-consuming hydration to bring them back and then chopping before use. Now, we have a shortcut. Simply grind them in a spice grinder. Here's how to do it. Break the dried mushrooms into coarse pieces, put them in a spice grinder, and then grind them to a fine dust in just a few seconds. Now, any variety works, although we like Chinese mushrooms or Japanese shiitakes or porcinis, they seem to have the strongest flavors. Once you have the mushroom dust, you can add them to any pasta sauce, a pan sauce, or even use them as a crust on meat for a deep, savory flavor boost. Adam Gopnik is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Recently, his son took a job as a bartender in Baltimore, and Gopnik has a few interesting observations about what his son's generation is drinking these days. Adam, how are you?
I am very well today, Christopher. How are you?
I my mind needs some exercise, and that's why I'm calling. So
I am a human stationary bike. That's all. That's what I'm here to do. Let me tell you a story, Chris. My wonderful son, Luke, went off to Baltimore this summer. He chased a girl to Johns Hopkins, where she was doing an internship. And he went off pounding the pavement in Baltimore till at last his feet led him to an artisanal hipster restaurant. And he talked his way into a job as a bartender. So he spent his summer as a bartender in Baltimore. And you can imagine the pride with which I articulated that truth to friends all over. What's Luke doing? Oh, he's spending the summer as a bartender in Baltimore. And you can also imagine the look of immeasurable pain that crossed his mother's face when I would say this, because it would imply that his fate in life was to be a bartender, not to be the philosopher, musician, filmmaker that, in fact, he is destined to be in her mind. But I was fascinated because he called me and wanted some advice about it. And I could give him a little bit of advice about wines, of course. But really what he was consumed in doing in the city of Baltimore all summer was making mixed drinks. And I got fascinated and thought a lot, and now I will ask you to work your knees around this problem, of why it is that 20-somethings, and Luke is 23, are so utterly in love with mixed drinks in a way that I think it's fair to say would have seemed to us generationally to be embarrassing. In other words, we associated Bronxes and Manhattans, perhaps not martinis, but that whole world of sweetened mixed drinks as something that only your Uncle Ron and your Aunt Ruth would be doing while they played canasta. But for 20-somethings, as you know, it is the mixed drink. That's what they love. And they regard us wine guzzlers with our swirling glasses and our long pulls and our ahs and oohs and can't you taste the terroir in there? They regard us with some embarrassment. They regard us, in fact, Christopher, with the same embarrassment with which we regarded our uncles and aunts and parents when they were having Bronxes and Manhattans and old fashions.
Well, I'm going to have to side with your son on this one because I have a mixed drink every evening, an old fashioned. And I'll say two things. There's a lovely quote from the 1925 Savoy Hotel cocktail book, one of the first. Mm-hmm. And the bartender said, cocktails should be had cold and fast. And mm-hmm. So I like that image of making a mixed drink and drinking it fast and cold. The second is a cocktail is a recipe. There's no recipe for wine. You have different components and you can use 100 different kinds of bitters and different kinds of simple syrups and different kinds of rye versus bourbon, different brands. There's a lot to do there. There's a formula. There's personal taste. There's my personal version. I think it's perfectly suited to a generation that is infinitely interested in the specifics of enjoyment.
Well, you have anticipated my conclusion.
I'm sorry.
Quite precisely. The first part of it, I think, is true. And I will confess that after a lifetime of wine drinking, I now have come to love a jot of dark rum mixed with coconut water or lime or any of the other wonderful things you can mix dark rum with before I open a bottle of wine. My wife also views this with some alarm. But I think the second thing is the crucial thing. You know, one of the most influential and important pieces of sociological research ever published in America was a paper by the great sociologist Howard Becker, who calls himself Howie Becker, all the way back in the 1940s. And it was called On the Consumption of Marijuana. It was so long ago that they spelled marijuana with an H. Do you remember the way they used to spell it in Reefer Madness and so on?
Yeah.
And in it, Howie Becker, who was a sociologist, but also a jazz pianist of some stature and capacity himself, wrote about this shocking thing. How is it that jazz musicians smoke marijuana? What's the sociology of smoking marijuana? And basically what he said is, you don't smoke the joint, you smoke the nightclub. In other words, what was the really appealing thing about it wasn't so much your response to the drug. What is pleasure-giving is all the apparatus,
right,
all of the lore, all of the folk culture that surrounds us. Remember, it takes a village to raise a child? Well, it takes a nightclub to smoke a reefer. That was Becker's point. That what we're really after is not so much the experience of the intoxication, which we can get a lot of different ways. What we're really after is being inducted into that charm circle. And exactly as you just said, Christopher, I think that's exactly the appeal of the mixed drink to my son's generation. There's a craft you have to learn. There's a language you have to master. There are recipes you have to follow. And so being a bartender in his generation isn't a lesser job. It's a higher job because you become the air traffic controller, so to speak, of your generation's inebriation.
Well, I'd say there's one other element. You know, I love the old Ian Fleming James Bond novels. I've read them a dozen times. When Bond goes to eat or drink, he always says, I'm extremely particular about my food because I travel a lot and I eat alone. And there was something about taking care and attention, how and what you drink and eat, which I found it's an example of how to live a rich and full life. And I believe in that. It's not finicky. It's not silly. There is a truth there. And I think I found it in the James Bond books. He cared about the experience, and he took the time to learn something about it. I think that's okay.
It's so funny you mention that. We've never discussed Ian Fleming or James Bond, but I completely share your absorption in them as a kid and right to this day. And it's true, and it's something that the movies never picked up on. Bond is very precise. I can remember the meals he has at Blades Club in Moonraker, or the meal he actually has in the first novel in Casino Royale. And he says, in England, I live on roast beef, but when I'm traveling, I want things precisely so. And to this day, I don't know if you remember, not only does he have the famous vodka martini, shaken, not stirred, but he also drinks Tattinger, which in those days was an unusual mark of champagne. And I've never opened a bottle of Tattinger, as I learned to call it in France, without a thrill of kinship with Bond. But I think every generation needs to learn a code of their own. Our generation, I do think, Christopher, learned the code of wine. We learned the varietals. We learned the areas of France. We learned how to be fussy and pretentious, no doubt, but also specific, as you said, how to be specific about wine. And it's fascinating in the endless cycling of generations that their generation, my son's generation, is learning to be specific about spirits. And every generation has to find, as Howie Becker explained so well, has to find not one potion that will inebriate them, but one room that they can belong in.
Adam, it's time to invest in cocktail shakers.
You bet. I'll meet you at the bar.
Adam Gopnik, thank you so much.
Pleasure talking, Chris.
That was Adam Gopnik, staff writer for The New Yorker. Harry Craddock, the head barman of the American Bar at the Savoy Hotel in London in the 1920s and 30s, once said that a cocktail should be drunk cold and fast. Now, I'm not one to argue with the likes of Harry Craddock, but his pronouncement begs an obvious question, which, of course, is, should pleasure be savored or taken? Now, I would note that those who worry about a deficit of pleasure savor it, while those who are confident of a surplus enjoy it quickly and boldly. Either way, as Nigella Lawson once said, those who feel guilty about pleasure don't deserve to have it. That's it for this week. If you just tuned in and missed our show, you can listen to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, or Spotify. Please remember to subscribe to the show. You'll automatically get every single show downloaded to your phone each week. If you want to learn more about Milk Street, please go to 177milkstreet.com. There you can download each week's recipe, subscribe to the magazine, watch our first season of Milk Street Television, or order the Milk Street Cookbook. We'll be back next week. Thanks so much for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producers Melissa Baldino and Stephanie Stender. Producer Amy Padula. Associate producer Carly Helmetag. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugarts. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison, with help from Vicki Merrick and Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help Debbie Paddock. Our theme music is by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.